KALW. And I said, well, I've decided I'm going to be a prosecutor. And you're all laughing because you probably have a sense of who my family is.
Vice President-elect Kamala Harris surprised the people closest to her when she chose her career.
She liked being a prosecutor, and she felt she was doing some good in what she did.
Today, in another episode from the new podcast, Chronicled, Who is Kamala Harris?, we hear why she chose that path. Then we'll hear a story from Uncuffed about what happens when a wild turkey lands on a prison yard.
It kicked my ass not once, but twice. I'm not going to go down a third time because I've got a reputation to protect.
The bird that fought back. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris spent her early childhood in Berkeley, but she also grew up outside the United States. A new series from the San Francisco Chronicle examines how Kamala's early life and career shaped who she is today. We're bringing you another episode from the podcast Chronicled, Who is Kamala Harris? This is episode 4.
Kamala Harris's family left Berkeley in 1977 when Shyamala Gopalan Harris got a teaching and research job at McGill University in Montreal. Kamala was 12.
One of her contemporaries told me Shyamala moved after getting passed over for a job in a time when women in science weren't well respected. That scientist, Mina Bissell, would later hire Shyamala at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory to bring her back to the East Bay.
Harris speaks very little about her time in Canada. There was a language barrier. She jokes that she sounded like a duck because she was constantly asking, quack, 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 what, what?
But those formative years paved the way for what would come next in Harris's life. The pivotal decision on where to get her education and what to learn. I'm Tal Cope.
And I'm Joe Garofoli. And this is Chronicle, Who is Kamala Harris? Episode 4, Why a Prosecutor? It was in high school in Montreal that Harris started to think about becoming a lawyer, in particular, a prosecutor. It happened after she learned that one of her best friends was being molested by her father. She talks about it in a campaign ad.
And so I said to her as soon as she told me, well, you have to come stay with us. And a big part of the reason I wanted to be a prosecutor was to protect people like her. And in fact, the vast majority of my career as a prosecutor was about protecting women and children, including a significant period of time where I specialized in child sexual assault cases.
But she yearned to go back to the U.S., and she decided to go to the same college as one of her heroes, the lawyer and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. So in 1982, she enrolled at Howard, a historically black university in Washington, D.C., that was founded in 1867, 2 years after the Civil War ended.
It takes you back in time to all of that legacy.
This is Jill Lewis, a friend of Harris's from Howard.
And that's what you feel when you walk the halls of campus. When you're on the yard, you really feel a sense of duty to take your place in that legacy.
She remembers a high school teacher asking her if she really wanted to go to a college where everyone was the same.
We were definitely not the same. We shared a heritage and we shared a legacy. But we came from everywhere. And so I had never met a woman who was South Asian and West Indian and had come from California and had the experiences that she had.
Here's Harris talking about Howard in her memoir, The Truths We Hold.
We weren't just told we had the capacity to be great. We were challenged to live up to that potential. There was an expectation that we would cultivate and use our talents to take on roles of leadership and have an impact on other people, on our country, and maybe even on the world.
Lewis and Harris met as sorority sisters at Alpha Kappa Alpha. AKA is not a sorority in the frat row sense. Long after college, its 300,000 members would also provide a vast network of influential and prominent backers and campaign volunteers for Harris.
Chronicle columnist Otis Taylor Jr. says that Greek life means something different in the black community.
Greek life for white people is very different from black people. You've got to understand that Greek life for black people, particularly on white campuses, it sprouted as out of a necessity for people to have like-minded people and people who looked like them an outlet to express themselves and not be vilified for it. But more so, it's about linking with a professional network for the rest of your career. So the idea was, when I was in college, my mother stressed to me that I had to join a black fraternity. So, you know, when I embarked on my career, I could get my foot in the door by reaching out to a member. That's what AKA is. I would say it's more about empowerment of the black woman. The black woman is more than your mammy. We're more than your house cleaners. We're more than your seamstresses. We can be business leaders. We can be lawyers. Hell, we can even be presidents. That is what that organization represents.
I want to point out that Otis didn't take his mom's advice and join a fraternity. Jill Lewis recalls one night when 38 of their sorority sisters jammed into a three-bedroom apartment. Some were working on service projects, some were preparing dinner, many were sitting on the floor. A discussion broke out, Lewis remembers, that was so on brand for Kamala because it was equal parts serious and equal parts laughing and joking.
She talked about what it was like to have the heritage that she had and to be called derogatory names about a variety of heritages. She could receive derision for her South Asian heritage. She could receive derision for being a black woman. And she could receive derision for being a woman who was the child of immigrants. And she was talking about that experience and how you learn to brush it off, how you keep moving no matter what people are saying. And then we segue pretty quickly into who had the best recipe for curry chicken.
Lewis says the environment at Howard wasn't just about being supportive. It was also about tough love, and it prepared Harris for the attacks she'd face in the political world.
Do not think that this is just a situation where there's always praise. There's correction. There's uplifting in all those ways. It's iron sharpening iron.
Lewis says Howard students didn't wear jeans much. It was business casual in the yard and in class. In their time, the highest compliment you could give someone was thorough, as in, she's thorough. She can get the job done. She says there were cool people, but it wasn't about being cool. It was about achieving.
Fortified with that belief in herself, honed in Berkeley and at Howard, Harris came home to the Bay Area to attend law school at the University of California's Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco. When Harris told her friends and family that she wanted to become a prosecutor, many of them were incredulous. They knew the history of prosecutors framing people of color without evidence, of using the power of the office to perpetuate injustice. But Harris wanted to change the system from the inside. She thought of the legacy of prosecutors who went after the Klan in the South, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy protecting freedom riders. And she thought of her mother saying, "Don't let anybody tell you who you are. You tell them who you are." So she told her family who she wanted to be.
And I said, "Well, I've decided I'm going to be a prosecutor." And you're all laughing because you probably have a sense of who my family is. But what I said then is what I absolutely maintain today after a career as a prosecutor. Law enforcement has such a profound and direct impact on the most vulnerable among us and has as its responsibility and job to not only give those often voiceless people a voice in a system, not only give them safety, but also give them dignity.
She started in the Alameda County District Attorney's Office in 1989. Judge Carol Brosnahan remembers Harris as a baby prosecutor at the Berkeley Municipal Courthouse in the late 1980s.
A lot of attorneys think they can get by on their charm, their talent, but she worked at it. She wasn't an easy prosecutor in terms of being a softy, but she was not an unreasonable person either. And that's a talent in a prosecutor. I mean, sometimes you'll have prosecutors who try to treat a petty theft case like a murder, and she didn't do that.
Brosnahan retired this year after 41 years on the bench. She was a Harvard Law School classmate of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the late 1950s. They were two of only nine women in a class of 525. While there were more young female lawyers when Harris started practicing law in the late 80s, Brosnahan says the sexism was still around.
I had somebody say to me, well, you know, how should I address you? And I'd say, well, Your Honor would be fine, but I still, at my advanced age, there were a couple of defendants who called me sweetie.
Judge Brosnahan was married to James Brosnahan, a partner at Morrison & Foerster, one of San Francisco's most prestigious law firms. She wanted to recommend Harris for a job there.
I saw a lot of attorneys come through in the 41 years that I was a judge. I think I recommended three altogether to go to work for my husband. And Camel was probably one of the first.
But Harris declined the offer.
She liked being a prosecutor, and she felt she was doing some good in what she did. I've always been impressed with people who find their niche. They know what they're good at.
She chose the hardest way on all sides because law enforcement didn't trust her. And you can see that advocacy groups have been uncomfortable with the idea of someone who's ever been a prosecutor.
This is Susie Loftus, a longtime friend and colleague of Harris. We heard from her in episodes 1 and 2. She says Harris chose to be a prosecutor because of the values she grew up with.
So she chose a path that was, that there was natural conflict inherent in it. But I think she did that because she recognized that bringing those, she had the unique ability to bring those worlds together and start a new chapter of we're not going to relegate law enforcement exclusively to people who have one ideology.
Harris spent 9 years as a prosecutor in Alameda County before the San Francisco DA's office hired her away in 1998. That office was run by Terrence K.O. Hallinan, a hero in local progressive circles. He was a year away from winning re-election, but 4 years after that, he would run again and lose to Kamala Harris. In 1998, the DA's office was a mess, a huge backlog of cases, one computer for every two attorneys, no database to track cases. It didn't even have email. Plus, morale was terrible. One day, 14 attorneys returned from lunch to find out they'd been fired. After 18 months, Harris moved over to the city attorney's office, hired by Louise Rennie, the first woman to hold that job in San Francisco. Harris led a team that worked on family and children's services, and she worked on policies that the Board of Supervisors eventually adopted. It was that success that reinforced her view that she could make changes from within the system. But she still wanted to be a prosecutor, so she started making plans to run for district attorney.
That's when Susie Loftus met Kamala Harris. She'd just come home from the East Coast to go to law school and heard Harris speak at a domestic violence consortium meeting in San Francisco.
She spoke about the role of the prosecutor as someone who really stood up for victims and who was a champion of civil rights. And she talked about her personal story at that time of coming from a family of people who cared about civil rights and how she had to defend her choice to be a prosecutor. So it's interesting because the very first time I ever heard her speak, she was talking about this conflict or this apparent conflict between being someone who cares deeply about communities and justice and civil rights and who chose a career as a prosecutor.
Gary Delanis was the head of the San Francisco Police Union. We heard from him earlier as well. He'd heard that Harris was planning to run from Mayor Willie Brown, who dated Harris in the mid-1990s and later appointed her to two state commissions while he was still leading California's assembly. Delanis started calling cops in East Bay and prosecutors he knew in Alameda County to learn more about Harris. Her reputation with them was good.
She was a pretty good prosecutor. I checked her out with the Oakland Police Officers Association, who obviously dealt with her all the time, and they said that they felt she did a pretty good job as a prosecutor over there.
But the police union was going to endorse Bill Fazio. He was a defense attorney who had represented some police officers and was more conservative than Hallinan. Then Delanis got a call from a wealthy donor to the National Democratic Party who lives in San Francisco. The donor wanted to have lunch. So they met at the Washington Square Bar and Grill, then a power lunch spot for political players in town. They like to call it the wash bag.
So I met him for lunch at the wash bag, and he said, oh, you know, I just got off the plane. I've been playing golf with Bill, you know, your ship Clinton, you know, like name dropping. And oh, yeah, you know, I was never a guy that was that fascinated with big talkers, but I said, yeah, okay, great. She said, well, you ought to be endorsing Kamala. And I said, well, you know, we're endorsing Fazio, but we can talk again if there's a runoff. Oh, you know, you're making a big mistake. She's going to be president of the United States someday. I'll never forget it. He said that. And I looked at him like, you know, what are you smoking? And I'm sitting back, look at this guy going, is this guy full of shit or does he know more than I know? Well, he knew a lot more than I knew.
As we talked about in episode 2, Harris had to get through some other elections first. But she did. And in 2016, she punched her ticket to the nation's capital.
That's what we talk about next time on Chronicle. Kamala Harris goes to Washington and takes a big left turn.
That was episode 4 of the podcast Chronicled, Who is Kamala Harris? From the San Francisco Chronicle. The series is reported by Joe Garofoli and Tal Copen, produced by King Kaufman. You can subscribe to the podcast or tune in tomorrow at 5 to hear the next episode in the series. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we've got a story from the Uncuffed team at Solano State Prison in Vacaville.
From Solano State Prison,
this is Uncuffed.
Uncuffed producer Brian Mazza brings us a story about a dramatic conflict on the yard just in time for Thanksgiving. Here's Brian remembering what happened along with his friend Joseph Kaufman.
George Washington versus the British. David versus Goliath. Ali versus Frazier. These are just a few of the great battles throughout history. Today we at Uncuffed are presenting you with a story about a man versus a turkey. I sat down with Brian Mazza and Joseph Kaufman and let them tell me all about it.
You know, Joe, I wanted to ask you, man. Remember that time? I think it was about Thanksgiving last year.
Somewhere
around. Saw that turkey on the yard.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, is that turkey inside the fence line? Because I couldn't even fathom. How's the turkey going to get inside the fence?
You know, they can fly a little bit.
I had no idea that turkeys could fly.
Yeah, I didn't expect one to be there on the yard, though. You said, let's get it! And you took off running. And I was just started laughing. And then I followed you. But I walked and you ran. And when you got to the fence, the turkey was scared out of his wits. And it didn't know what to do. So it took off running into building 23.
I lived in that building, too. And I ran inside the building and said, stop that turkey! I'm going to have him for lunch! And everybody in the building was just looking at me. And I ran up the stairs, and the turkey landed on the railing in front of the showers. There's like 5 people in the showers, and the turkey's looking in the shower. He's looking at me. He's looking in the shower. He's looking at me. And people were in the showers going, no, don't do it. I grabbed the turkey, and feathers just came out of it. Because I didn't want to hurt it, but feathers just came out of its wings.
There were feathers everywhere. Yeah.
There are feathers everywhere.
What I saw was the turkey looking into the shower, and the turkey looks at Brian, and then it takes off, and then it takes off down the tier. So now the turkey is running for its life down the tier, and here comes Brian running after it, and the turkey scrambles up against the wall, and at the corner of the corner of the tier, and I just started laughing at that point. I was laughing so much, everyone was laughing.
I almost fell down. The turkey ran into the wall because they're fast too. I didn't know they were that fast.
It was pretty quick.
Yeah. It could fly. It was fast. I was learning as I went along there. The turkey ran, but its claws cannot get any kind of traction on the linoleum, and it slipped right into the wall of 20 dorm, right into the cinder block wall. And then the turkey runs down the tier into 24 dorm, and down there, there was that guy. Remember his name? What was his name? He was the big skinhead with Hitler tattooed on him and everything else. I forget. He was the toughest guy in the whole yard, right? And the turkey ran into his bed area while dude with Franco, that's his name, Franco. And the turkey ran into his bed area and woke him up. And he stood up like one of those things, you ever see the cartoons where somebody stands up and runs in place and then takes off and there's like little air pockets behind him? Well, that's what he did, right? And he took off out of the dorm. I ran into the dorm, and I'll tell you something. The turkey was hiding under the bed, and it was between the locker and the wall. And I look, I bend down, I get on my hands and knees, and I'm looking, and the turkey's peeking at me from around the corner, seeing me. And I go, all right, I don't want to hurt him. That's one thing I don't want to do. I'm thinking animal lover, a conservationist. That was probably my main reason why I started chasing the turkey to begin with, was because I didn't want it to get hurt. So here I am, I'm going to stick to that theme. So I reached underneath the bed, and I'm reaching my arm, and I finally grabbed a hold of its wing and dragged it out, and then I discovered something new. They can fly, they're fast, and they're mean as hell.
How about strong? Are they strong?
It was a 12-pound bird. It's unbelievable how strong birds are. So I grab it, right? I'm still trying not to grab its neck or, you know, these things, right? And the birds, ca-ca, started flapping its wings, and it just kicked the shit out of me. I dropped it on the ground and fell back, and it ran underneath the bed again. I'm thinking to myself, Jesus, that's a strong bird. I was like, wow, everybody's laughing.
Lucky it didn't slice you open.
It didn't slice me open. Lucky for me, because I didn't know that part either. They're very aggressive, mean birds. But for some reason, this one gave me a break. So I dive underneath the bed again, and I grab him by his leg this time, and it just, I had it by the leg, and it was trying to flap, and this is people's bed area. It's clean, it's orderly, it's supposed to be quiet. There's feathers everywhere in that dorm, fluttering, flying around. Indians were going, hey, these are nice feathers. Everybody, Mexicans, everyone's coming to get the feathers. And I go, I grabbed the bird, and finally I grabbed it by its neck, because you know what? It kicked my ass not once, but twice. I'm not going to have it go down a third time, because I've got a reputation to protect, right? So I grabbed the turkey by the neck, and I grabbed him by his leg, and there I was, stretching him out so he couldn't kick or flap on me, and I carried him out of the building. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do with this turkey now, right?
The whole building was like caught in suspense. Because we were all just wondering what's going to happen. And it was taking a long time. I was like, everyone was really curious. And then finally you came down the stairs holding this turkey like a trophy, but away from you. Like it was like a dangerous trophy.
It was dangerous.
That part was hilarious too. But the whole building was just quiet. If I remember right, when you were bringing the turkey down.
I remember that cop Webster, he goes, good job, Maza. And I go, all right. And I was all proud of myself. I had my bruises and a couple scrapes. You know what I mean? It was a hard-fought battle. And I finally got the bird outside. And then I don't know what I'm going to do. What am I going to do? Because, believe it or not, all the feathers I tore out of the tail and I tore out of the wings. The bird wasn't going to be able to fly out. So I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Throw the thing back over the fence? Or what am I going to do? So I walked towards where the cops were at in front of the center complex, and I go, I don't know what we're going to do with this bird, right? And they go, well, we'll just carry it outside, but we'll go get Lamb, Officer Lamb. So I sit down at the picnic table, and I'm thinking, man, maybe the bird will stay still. So I set him down on top of the picnic table.
Feather explosion.
That's when I started getting my ass kicked for the third time, because it was flapping and it was making these noises, and I had to grab it because I didn't want it to get away again. So that was three ass whoopings I took from the turkey. And I finally said, here, I gave the turkey over to Lamb, and he took the bird out, took it out and put it out in the parking lot in front of the prison and let it go.
Yeah, you paroled it. paroled the turkey.
The turkey got an early parole.
I think that they release feathers when they're scared as a defense mechanism, because the third time,
right,
there were feathers flying everywhere again. People were running around picking them up. Yay, feathers.
That's cool. You know, I learned on the fly. I'm not an ornithologist by a far sight. At the end of the day, I was glad that I caught it, but I still have people coming up and talking to me, hey, turkey man, and I don't mind that at all. If everybody's going to have a laugh, then I'm happy about it.
All right, turkey man.
That was Brian Mazza talking with Joseph Kaufman, and that piece was produced by Joe Kirk, who was a producer in KALW's program at Solano State Prison. And there's an extended version of that story on the Uncuffed podcast. You can find it at weareuncuffed.org. Uncuffed is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability. All content is approved by an information officer. Today's Cross Currents team includes Scott Carroll, Sonia Narang, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Lisa Ramreka. Our engineers are James Rowlands and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.